Welcome to ASAP Nowcast, highlighting the very best content from this month's issue of ASAP Now, the magazine of the American College of Emergency Physicians and the official voice of emergency medicine. I'm your host, ASAP Now Medical Editor-in-Chief, Jeremy Faust.
Okay, let's hop right into it. We got some COVID this month and some bread and butter emergency medicine. Maybe you're rusty on that because there was so much less emergency medicine basically every day around the country in the spring. It started to come back online as people basically realized, well, I gotta go to the ER, so I'm gonna stop not going, and starting to show up again, and with it a lot of stuff that we maybe are rusty on. So here's one that I think is great. This is a column that we have by Britt Long, Alex Koifman, and Michael Gottlieb, looking at five myths of ovarian torsion. And I think we all kind of know this is an important one not to miss, but the myths can really mess you up. So let's go through them. Myth number one, only women of reproductive age experience ovarian torsion. That can be a very big cognitive error. Big fact I thought was really interesting, 15% of ovarian torsion cases are going to occur in pediatric patients. So that's not one of the cases you want to miss, is it? And the biggest risk, actually, even though, of course, typically it is that reproductive age patient, but the biggest risk, maybe not a surprise, the adnexal mass larger than 5 centimeters, which occurs in up to 80% of patients with ovarian torsion. The risk factors, things we know about, polycystic ovarian syndrome. Definitely always ask about whether a patient is getting fertility treatment. That's another one that can really increase the likelihood of torsion. And like anything in emergency medicine, the history of the previous event, the previous torsion. The one I thought was interesting is the history of tubal ligation. That one is always a little scary because you think, oh, well, you know, they have a ligation, so what can happen? But no, it can still happen, and in fact, it's actually more likely. The next myth to go on to is that all patients with ovarian torsion present with the classic acute severe pain and vomiting. And the big thing to know here is that, you know, we classically ask, is it kind of on again, off again? Very hard to elicit that history, by the way. I always find that's really tough to get the patients to say that because they don't necessarily know what we're getting at. And a lot of times they're trying to read our minds. Like, does she want me to say, or does she want me to say this or that? And so we're asking, oh, is it come and go? And they want to say, no, it's always there. This is a serious thing, doc. And we're sitting there saying, no, coming and going would be worse. I've actually done that. I've actually said to a patient before, if it's coming and going, the OBGYN consultants are going to be more likely to show up sooner because that's a buzzword for them for a condition that they don't want to miss. And so then the patient will say, oh, in that case, the pain is on and off again, doc. So it's of course, be careful what you wish for because sometimes the patients will go with whatever you say. You don't want to manipulate them. But I have noticed that if you tell them the agenda behind your question, sometimes you get a different answer and sometimes a more honest answer. And in this part of the column, I thought this was so interesting because the sudden severe pain only occurs in 50% of the patients. Most of the patients, 90%, have some kind of pain. Obviously, that's why they came in, although there's other symptoms like nausea and vomiting, which is there in 70% of patients. But it's really not necessary to have this on again, off again, this sort of sudden lightning bolt, severe, abrupt, intermittent pain. You can actually have a lot of different presentations. So don't be fooled by the lack of that sort of famous historical colicky off again, on again pain. Myth number three, normal physical exam, including a pelvic exam, can rule out torsion. Now, I don't think too many of us will be fooled by that. So I think a lot of us realize that if we have a normal GU exam, including an internal exam, that we're going to say, oh, well, it can't be torsion. Obviously, I think most of us would say on the history, we'd get a little bit more concerned enough to maybe get imaging of some kind. And what's interesting here, not only the detection of adnexal tenderness or a mass on exam, pretty unreliable when you look from one rater to another, the inter-examiner reliability, the range is actually in the 20 and 30% range, 23 to 32% agreement about whether or not there's an adnexal tenderness or mass. And you think, oh, well, let's get the OBGYN to do the exam and they're going to have better sort of built-in test characteristics because their N is so much higher. Yeah, turns out not so much. The results are not better with a gynecologist perform exam, another example of how emergency medicine basically can do everyone else's job pretty well, which I like to remind us all that we're kind of all the other doctors into one, as we all like to be. But what's interesting is that even with a mass that's greater than 5 centimeters, the sensitivity on that is really not great. It's actually 36% at best, and even lower in some cases. And then, of course, it can get a little bit dicey if you have a patient with obesity, because it's harder to get that exam. Moving on, myth number 4, a normal ultrasound can rule out torsion. This one, I think, is scary because you kind of stop. You think, okay, they had a really good ultrasound. They didn't have anything scary. Scary things like the string of pearls sign, which would be an enlarged ovary, which is sort of has a periphery of follicles around it that is suggesting torsion. The big pitfall here is to realize that the normal ultrasound might not be 100% the end of the story. And the reason for that is that the Doppler there is going to pick up pretty good arterial flow, but a lot of these cases really do stem out of lymphatic flow and out of venous flow problems, and the ultrasound may not catch that. So that actually leads us to myth number 5, which I think is really important. The CT of the abdomen and pelvis has no role in evaluating ovarian torsion. That's a myth, and that's a myth we should not stick with. And I've really become impressed where I work with the radiologist's ability to pick up the secondary signs of torsion. And in fact, when they're present, the sensitivity is excellent. So it turns out that things like an enlarged ovary or fat stranding or pelvic fluid, free fluid, maybe you have a mass, maybe you have an adnexal mass, that's another one. Uterine deviation is another one towards the torsed ovary. I think that's a great one. Uterine deviation towards the torsed ovary. Makes sense, kind of that mass effect that things are getting twisted up and so the uterus gets pulled over. So I love this. I think that honestly, I absolutely get the ultrasound first, but my algorithm, I think as many of you do as well, is the ultrasound and then get the CT. But I think a lot of us get the CT because we're thinking, well, if it's not the ovaries, if it's not torsion, then maybe it's something else like appendicitis. But in fact, the CT is also sort of involved in the ovarian torsion workup. And I think that's a really important adjunct. All right, next up, let's do another non-COVID topic, especially great for the summertime. There's still some summer to go. This is heat-related illnesses, and it's by Ashley Jacobson and Neha Raukar. This is really nice. There's some great definitions, some new changes in the ICD codes to be aware of. Let's go through those real quick and then some of the therapeutics. Heat edema is the first definition to go through, and that's just vasodilatation of the hands. And you're really going to see this in unacclimatized elderly patients in a supportive treatment. We see this all the time. They come in and they're swollen up, and if it's the legs, it's pretty easy, the compression stockings. So that's kind of on the sort of the usual progression of illness related to positional edema a lot of the times. The heat cramp is the next one. This is the involuntary contraction. It sounds like the Charlie horse, right? And again, just supportive stuff, hydration, stretching, and actually massage is supposed to help there. Then we get into the more interesting emergency department diagnoses, the heat syncope, the heat exhaustion, the heat fatigue, if that's a thing, and then the heat stroke and sunstroke. So let's just go through these real quickly. The heat syncope, this is the exercise-associated collapse, and it's definitely a clinical diagnosis, and it involves the idea that the decrease in venous return after the activity has ceased, this is going to be peripheral venous pooling that'll cause a syncope. But you always do want to make sure that you aren't misled and think about cardiac causes, other causes of syncope. Next, heat exhaustion. And that's the inability to maintain the cardiac output from exercise or strenuous activity that's compounded by the environmental heat stress. And the one with heat exhaustion that I think is interesting is very frequently, this is the sodium derangements. So the sodium derangements you're going to pick up on labs. With these people, they might have some mild CNS dysfunction, but pretty much are going to have a normal mental status with that heat exhaustion. And they're going to get better with rest, with supine positioning, elevation of the legs, and hydration. I think that's really, the sodium derangements go away quickly, pretty self-resolving. This is not an ICU level of sodium derangement in most cases. And of course, you can cool these folks to make sure that they don't progress on to something worse like heat stroke. The ICD-10 code for heat fatigue transient is now in the books, and basically this code is for patients who sort of don't fall into anything else. They sort of fall between the cracks. But let's get to the guts of it, the heat stroke and sunstroke. Heat stroke is defined as a core body temperature of 104 degrees Fahrenheit or 40 Celsius with CNS dysfunction due to a substantial environmental heat load or exposure that you can't adequately get rid of real quickly, so it's sustained. And a lot of younger people will get this in the, classically, they overdid it on a summer day going for a run and they're just not in shape, or there's possibly other reasons for dehydration, but there's other things that are on the differential too to think about, such as any congenital disorders that might predispose people to not be able to regulate. And the signs and symptoms are pretty much, as you know, the tachycardia, the tachypnea, hypotension. The thing that I think gets real interesting is, are they ataxic? Do they have any muscle flaccid findings? Do they have encephalopathy? That is where you get real interested in these folks, especially with the encephalopathy, because then you're worrying about, is there sort of an altered mental status from hyponatremia from another cause, or is it neuroleptic malignant syndrome in patients who take medications that could cause that? So it's really important to think about with these patients the broader differential. But then the real question, I think this is also a good one if you're recertifying or taking your boards, is the treatment for heat stroke and sunstroke. And the first line thing is this, again, not high quality evidence, but ice water immersion carries the 1A recommendation, a strong recommendation with the best evidence possible. And the ice water immersion is pretty specific: removing all the clothing, placing the patient in cold water or a tub, and letting them cool off. The second line is using the tarp assisted cooling, or a cold shower, or even hose them off. And then the evaporating cooling is a third line, and this is the fans and the lukewarm water. We always think of this as the thing that people do first, but actually it's sort of thing to do later. And then the fourth line recommendation is the ice packs. Again, you see all these pictures in the books, and that's the first thing they show, I guess, because it's so visual, but it's not the thing. The thing to think about also is, in patients with this condition, with your sunstroke, your heat stroke, is you might, again, not want to stop with just treatment. You may want to get a workup, and the typical ED workup is going to be there. I'm not going to go through all that, but these are the ones who maybe you think about rhabdomyolysis at the same time, so getting a creatinine kinase, maybe get the urine myoglobin. So that's the broader approach to the heat stroke and sunstroke. Love this article. Check it out in the June issue. All right, let's move on to some COVID topics. We had one that I really liked. This was a article by Jonathan Leggett, and it looks at the fact that during the COVID-19 period, emergency physicians have been basically kind of turned into sort of national heroes. Well, we always were, maybe, but now we're getting the credit for what we do. Anyway, this is a kind of a neat article that they looked at the fact that during the COVID-19 outbreak, the thing we love, or the thing we don't love, the Press-Ganey scores, actually went up a bunch for emergency physicians. And I think sometimes it does take a crisis like COVID-19 for people to really understand how hard it is to do what it is we do. And so we'll take the credit. Now, of course, we're going to hear later on about CMS maybe giving us a pay cut in the future, but that's not set in stone yet. So that'll be coming down the pipeline in a upcoming ASAP Now. Real quick shout out to a couple of features. One is the Coding Wizard, and another is an article about telemedicine. Telemedicine was by Shana Adams, Mita Shaw, and Braden Hexum, and really nice idea of using telemedicine in terms of residency training and participation. This is something that we're going to have to train our residents to do and ourselves, so check that out. It's a nice one. Another one is the Coding Wizard. Doesn't always get highlighted, but it's one of those essential features in ASAP Now because it really helps us figure out like what to do in terms of our charts, and it usually just occupies a little space in the magazine. But now there's some updates with respect to coding with COVID, so check that out, especially some information about EMTALA and telemedicine. So I just want to alert you to that. Great service to you and me, quite frankly. I'm really grateful for that. Another article we've got in the magazine, check it out, is a little bit of information about the various tests that are out there for COVID-19. I think we'll have to update this because it's a moving landscape, but this is really nice stuff in the EM Lit of Note by Ryan Radecki, so check that out. Another one that I want to alert you to that's in there is the ASAP for You feature, which is really written consistently well by one of our ASAP staffers, Jordan Grantham. And there's a lot going on here. We all know that this has been a taxing period, and this month there's a lot to look into in terms of the support pathways, peer support for wellness during this time. And I think it's really time to get rid of the stigma around talking about mental health challenges as a field. It's not easy, this job, especially in times like this. So ASAP has a nice bunch of resources. Please check those out. If you want to know where your dues are going, that's one of the places. And I think it's probably underutilized, quite frankly. So let's check that out. And speaking of wellness, one of the features that I introduced when I took over as the editor-in-chief of ASAP Now was the residency spotlight. And the reason is I feel like residencies are such an amazing time of life. It's so hard. I'm not that far away from it. But it's easy to feel like you're forgotten. And there's so many great programs. So every month we try to highlight one great residency around this country. And this month, I thought it was really nice to do Mount Sinai, which happens to be where I went to residency. Now, we've been doing this feature for over a year, so I don't want you to think that I only do my friends. I waited a year to do my own residency. And they did such a great job because they also, the emergency medicine residency at Mount Sinai is also half of the time they are at Elmhurst Hospital in Queens, which is really one of the epicenters of the COVID crisis. And they just did amazing work. So big shout out to them for the great work they've done over the years, just in terms of medical education, but now in the moment of COVID. Now let's wrap up with a couple of non-COVID topics. Front page, we had an article called Getting Patients to the Ballot Box, Emergency Departments Can Play an Active Role by Jonathan Kushner, Laura Dean, and Alistair Martin. And this is a project called Vote ER. And what they're basically doing is, think about this, people are sitting around in the waiting room doing nothing or waiting, so why not register to vote? And no one's saying who to vote for, no one's saying you have to register one party or another, just use that time to do something that's a civic duty, which is to get ready to vote. So they have kiosks and they're doing it by text. And this is an amazing thing because we all know that the emergency department is not just the epicenter of medicine. It's kind of the epicenter for so many aspects of life. And it's really where a lot of society's problems play out. And what's the best way to deal with that? Well, vote. Be a citizen and vote if you can. So this is a really great article. We actually, I'll share with you, we got a couple of emails from people saying this is really not emergency medicine. But, you know, I think it was worth giving space to here because people are looking at our space, the emergency department, and realizing how much can be done there. Imagine if we didn't do social work in the ER. We do such great things outside of just the life-saving treatment. We have really embraced, I think, the field by and large, has embraced our role as a safety net for so many different issues, including dealing with homelessness problems, dealing with social work problems about domestic abuse and intimate partner violence. So voting is just another thing that we can say, hey, you're here, you're waiting for your CAT scan. Let's face it, it's probably gonna be negative. They're feeling good, they're on their phones, they're texting. Why not register to vote? So that's a great article. And by the way, the lead author on that, or the senior author on that, was Alistair Martin. And about a month after, or maybe a little bit more than that, after we published this in ASAP Now, there was a big feature about Dr. Martin and this project in the New York Times. So ASAP Now, getting ahead of the New York Times. Always love it when we can do that. Can't promise that'll always happen. And then finally, let's look at one more article for the month, and that is the policy prescriptions. This is Dr. Cedric Dark's space in our, it's kind of our health policy journal club, if you will. And Joshua Ellis wrote the main article here, and the article that they looked at really has to do with the zip codes and whether there's any pre-hospital bias in terms of where patients go, where do they get diverted, do they end up going to one ER or another, do they go to safety net hospitals, what do we find? And it turns out that, you know, not surprisingly, there is some degree of sort of sorting that goes on, and it's a discrimination, you could say, or disparities in which people who are getting picked up by EMS are getting diverted to one hospital or another, really based on things that shouldn't be at play. And basically what I mean by is what they look like. So this is a really interesting thing that there's implicit bias even in the sort of ambulance and EMS space. And as emergency medicine physicians and as leaders, we, many of us, or many of you, I suspect, are sitting on committees or work with people who make policy. So this is the kind of thing where you look into it and you say, hey, let's do better on this, because no one actually wants to be part of a system where there is unnecessary discrimination, and we want to give our patients the most appropriate care no matter who they are and what their resources are in terms of where they come from. Okay, so that wraps it up for the June episode of ASAP Nowcast. There is so much more in this magazine. In fact, this magazine is doing so well. We got two major awards in the sort of health journalism, medical professional magazine award space. We got two biggies. One for an article by Dr. Kimi Chernobyl about how she was able to change the laws in her state about emancipated minor care while she was a resident. I mean, that's pretty amazing. And then our October issue, which had some really great stuff on vaping and other things, got a special award as well. So shout out to all of you all for sending your ideas and for telling us what works and what doesn't work, and ASAP and all your dues, which actually pays for all this to make it happen. Wiley's doing a great job. So really proud of what we're doing and always open to feedback. So let me know what you'd like to see in the magazine. Sometimes we can do it, sometimes we can't, but it's always good just to have that dialogue going. So check us out. We're pretty easy to find. We're probably in your daily email box. Check those out. There's such great content. Just take a look. 30 seconds. You probably learned something you didn't know. We're definitely on the internet, as you are well aware of, ASAP Now. And you can also email me your ideas at jfaust@asap.org. I really think it's great to have that feedback. We're doing our best to reflect this college and this whole profession, which is a pretty big tent, which is really fun, which makes this so much fun to talk about. All right, thank you for what you do and continuing to bring the great, up-to-the-minute, evidence-based, thoughtful care that you bring to all your patients. I'm appreciative. I know your patients are appreciative. So until next time, this is Jeremy Faust for ASAP Nowcast saying thanks and see you soon.
ASAP Now is published by Wiley and is a product of the American College of Emergency Physicians. The views expressed on ASAP Nowcast are those of the host and any guests. Our music is provided by Caroline Shaw and So Percussion. Thanks for listening.